This is the McKinsey Podcast, where we help you make sense out of our world's toughest business challenges.
Welcome to the show. I'm Lucia Raheli.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro.
Many times, physicians have not been trained in understanding that heart attacks manifest differently for women than for men. One of the studies from a few years ago quantified this as women having 7 times higher likelihood of dying than showing up to an emergency room with symptoms of a heart attack.
That's McKinsey's senior partner, Lucy Perez. She and senior partner Quaylen Ehlingrud joined me to discuss a report that McKinsey recently published. It's about how to close the women's health gap, and in the process, capture a $1 trillion opportunity.
After, what do you do when you realize you're losing your audience during a work presentation? Hear a key career lesson from senior partner Sharina Ibrahim.
Quaylen, Lucy, thanks so much for joining the podcast today.
Our pleasure, Roberta.
Looking forward to our conversation, Roberta.
Women's health is often oversimplified, right, to include only sexual and reproductive health, which meaningfully underrepresents a lot of women's health burden. There's so much more to it than that, right? How do we define women's health for the purposes of this report?
We define women's health holistically, right, from the very beginning of that life cycle all the way till the end, from birth through adolescence, through kind of working years into later years, and then, you know, retirement and older age as well.
Lucy, what are some of the common misperceptions about women's health?
The first one is the myth of how we define women's health, right? It's not just sexual and reproductive health, but indeed it encompasses any condition that impacts women uniquely, differently, or disproportionately. And actually, one of the analyses that we did showed that when we look at the health burden on women, actually the vast majority of that health burden is associated with conditions that are not unique to women. Another one of the myths that you often hear is that because women live longer, they are healthier. Mm-hmm. And indeed, what this research shows is that while it is true that women live longer, they actually spend a lot more time in poor health, 25% more time on average than men. There are other myths, for example, that this health gap happens primarily in those later years in life. But in fact, what we have found is that the majority of this health gap happens during women's prime working years. And as a result of that, it has significant economic impact not addressing this health gap.
So what's interesting to me is that the report, we do a deeper dive into some of the main causes for this gap. In the report, we outline 4 main causes: science related to women's health, levels and types of care provided to women versus men, investments in women's health, and data associated with women's health. I'd like to learn more about each of these. First of all, science. How is science contributing to this health gap?
Science is one of the main contributors to this health gap because of this persistent lack of appreciation for sex-based differences. For too long, science has thought of women as small men. You developed a product, right? You develop a drug, and it is okay to test it only in men, which, by the way, was what was happening through 1993. Women only started participating in clinical trials at scale since 1993. So as a result of this, we don't have as much data and evidence to understand those sex-based differences, how they manifest, and the implications that those then have in how we should treat women to get optimal outcomes for everyone. And so the science and the data go hand in hand. We looked at over 650 academic publications to understand what is the evidence that exists on whether there are sex-based differences and what is then the impact on health outcomes. What was really interesting to me as we looked at the 650 plus papers that together account for interventions that represent about 85% of the women's health burden is that in about half of the papers, there was no mention of whether there were sex-based differences. No one had even asked the question, are there sex-based differences? But in the half of the papers that did ask the question, 2/3 of the time, the outcomes for women were worse than they were for men. 10% of the time, the outcomes were worse for men than they were for women. What I take away from this analysis is just the criticality of even asking the question, are there sex-based differences? That is step number one. And the reality is that many times we actually don't know the answer. We haven't gathered the evidence. And so that missing data, that understanding of how do things manifest differently for different groups is one of the big reasons why we find ourselves with this health gap that we're talking about.
Lucy, I imagine that there's another aspect that we look at around care and how care for men and care for women it looks different. We've all heard the anecdotal evidence of that around cardiovascular disease and how those symptoms present differently, and yet the treatment is not always the same. What are the health gaps there around care?
I love, Roberta, that you bring up cardiovascular disease, because again, when we look at it from a numbers perspective, it is the number one killer of women. And it is a condition where we do know, and the evidence is there, that some of these conditions will manifest differently in men and women. For example, heart attacks, right? There's the typical understanding and representation, even in the media, that the heart attack, you feel this pressure, you know, on your left side. But the reality is, for many women who suffer from a heart attack, it may manifest as a general feeling of discomfort, nausea, just feeling something is off. And as a result of this, they show up to the emergency department, and many times physicians have not been trained in understanding that heart attacks manifest differently for women than for men. One of the studies from a few years ago quantified this as women having 7 times higher likelihood of dying upon showing up to an emergency room with symptoms of a heart attack. And that can be linked back to this idea that they were not getting sex-appropriate care, that their symptoms were being missed, were being minimized, and as a result of that, they may have been sent home instead of being looked after with the right care.
There was one other aspect in the report around how much investment there is in women's health. Curious to hear more about how much investment there is in women's health and where the gaps are there.
The investment is very limited in women's health. One of the analyses that we did was look at the spend in research and development dollars that is happening for assets in clinical development. So this is a way of getting an understanding of the next generation of medicines. And what you find is that there is less than 5% of research and development spending that is going towards women's health. Half of that is actually connected to oncology. But when you look at any other conditions like endometriosis, the total R&D spend is less than 2%. And when you think about conditions like endometriosis, which tends to affect 1 in 10 women, and you look at the pipeline of assets in development, you see that we're talking single digits. And yet there are other conditions that are equally prevalent, like diabetes. And you look at the pipelines that have 300 plus assets in development. That shines a light on what a significant gap there is.
How much is there to gain economically if we go ahead and address this health gap?
There's a significant economic opportunity. If we size this globally, it's about $1 trillion in GDP around the world by 2040. Perhaps more importantly, it's about 7 days of healthy living per woman every single year. And that's a really big deal. A lot of this is because a lot of this health burden actually falls during the working years, the economically productive years of a woman. And overall, if you add that up around the world, it's about 75 million what we call dailies or disability adjusted life years. When you break down that overall opportunity, right, 7 days per woman every single year, about 58%, almost 60% of it is around effectiveness, differences in treatments. Another, just about a third, 34%, is around care delivery. So Lucy was describing showing up to the emergency room and not getting the same kind of care. And then the final 8% is around a data gap. I believe we can flip this around and make it more of a virtuous cycle where we've got the science, we've got the data, and that leads to the investment, all driving to smaller gaps in care delivery. But overall, it's a huge economic opportunity, about $1 trillion globally. The impressive piece is that $1 trillion global economic opportunity is the equivalent of 137 million women accessing full-time positions by 2040. So it's an incredible boost to the workforce, to the economy. In some countries around the world, that is a significant GDP increase to have nearly 140 million women in full-time roles.
If we are looking, or we're talking to the investment community, if we're looking at VCs and investors, what are the areas of biggest market potential? You mentioned endometriosis. Are there particular areas where we're starting to see more investment, or where those opportunities are really huge?
There's significant opportunity across the board to sort of shift into that virtuous cycle we were talking about, both on the sort of high prevalence, but perhaps low kind of daily impact side of things. Certainly endometriosis, menopause is another where we're seeing a lot more interest, but still very little investment. And then on the other end of things, where it's a much more kind of serious disease, we talked a bit about heart attacks and heart conditions. Depressive disorders or mental health is another one where women experience them more. Autoimmune conditions and migraines, for example. So I think investment in a lot of these diseases where women are experiencing them either more at higher levels or differently. And it has a huge impact either in terms of prevalence or in terms of the disability life years that it affects, I think could be very exciting economic opportunities. Lucy, which ones would you be most excited about investing in?
People often ask me what has surprised you most in doing this research. And frankly, the average time to diagnosis for endometriosis is a scary number. I was having a conversation with a group of women and looking at how long it took them to get diagnosed, it ranged from 10 to 35 years. That is just simply unacceptable. You hear the stories of young girls who are being told, you're making this up to not go to school. No, they are suffering, right? And, you know, this is happening in their high school years, it's happening in the workplace. So endometriosis, I would say it's one that's very near and dear to my heart because of this long tail of suffering, right? And lack of acknowledgement that frankly, we've had for too long. Gratified to see the increasing attention, for example, that is happening in the cardiovascular space. And I think increasingly, we'll see much more of that also in other conditions like the autoimmune disorders that Quaylene was referring to.
What are some of the interventions that either organizations can take, individuals can take? What are some of the solutions that we can implement to close the gap?
I think this gets back to the nature of the gap that Lucy was describing. I think the biggest thing first is starting to ask that question, is there a gender difference? When does this intervention actually perform better for women versus men in the data? And closing that gap on the science side will lead to other improvements. It will lead to better data collection and sex disaggregation. And over time, with better data, both on valence, but also on kind of differences in the science, it will lead to better funding and better investments into the pipeline of different treatments. I also think this care gap that we talked about is critical. And that starts from very early stages of, you know, in medical school, how are we teaching the next generation of doctors? In actual practice, how are we closing those care gaps? There's a lot of research on both female patients, female doctors, when does pain get minimized, right? How do different care experiences happen based on gender of the patient, gender of the doctor? So I think there's a lot more that we can understand there and close those gaps much more systematically.
This is not just about those who are in the healthcare space. Everyone has a responsibility to play in helping to close the women's health gap. Because as Quaylene was saying, awareness is absolutely critical. Employers, for example, as they think about what are the business policies that are being put in place to support women's health. So for example, how do they think about the benefits that they are deploying to support women going through menopause? And so that's just one of the different ways that employers can also be thinking about their own role to play in closing the women's health gap. Hand in hand with all this, it is, of course, how are resources being deployed and allocated? How are we investing? Whether it is how we're investing as individuals, as organizations, right? Making sure that we are supporting the collection of the right data, the development of new tools and solutions that can help drive those better health outcomes, because everyone wins when women have better health.
We're all thinking and talking so much about generative AI and other technologies. What role does technology have to play in addressing the health gaps in some or all of the four areas that we just went over?
There are a lot of reasons why I'm optimistic and a couple reasons why I'm pretty cautious and a bit nervous about what the future of generative AI will look like for women's health. I'm optimistic because research and development is one of the top four use cases for generative AI, right? Generative AI dramatically shortens development, innovation cycles and can innovate in ways that we could only dream of before, right? So the ability to understand what potential new treatments could look like with generative AI is immense. And I love the potential there. On the other side of things, generative AI trains from data that already exists, can bake in or reinforce the bias that Lucy was describing in science and research already done, in lack of data that we have that does not sex disaggregate. We have to be quite cautious as we accelerate the pipeline for research and development that we're still not investing in the wrong places, that we're still kind of looking at gender disaggregated experiences and results.
In the nature of this conversation, we've been focused on gender-based research, but the reality is that, for example, we need to think of this also from an intersectional point of view, right? And if I think of women of color in particular, some of the insights that we had from the work that we did is that some of these health gaps are all the more pronounced for women of color. And so that really amplifies, you know, the requirement to have good data sets, right? And the data sets that ensure we minimize the risk of amplifying the biases that already exist today, because it is going to be true for women, but all the more so also for other vulnerable populations.
What do you hope people reading this report do with the findings, and sort of what would be the ideal situation, say in 5-10 years time, if people are reading this report? What does the future look like for women's health?
I think it is one of taking action, right? And that action manifests in much more enriched pipelines of products in development for all of these conditions for which we know there is a need for innovation. It is seen that there's many more research dollars that are being directed towards asking the question, are there sex-based differences and what do we do about that, right? It is recognizing that in every medical school, as part of academic curricula, you are teaching the next generation of physicians when there are sex-based differences, how those manifest, and that then this is, for example, incorporated into the clinical decision support tools that are increasingly being used. I mean, this is one of the more exciting applications of technology that can really, again, contribute to closing that health gap and make sure that we're always rapidly scaling the things that work and, frankly, not putting more investment behind things that we know are not working.
I love that action orientation, Lucy. I would love to see the 25% more years spent in poor health. I would love to see that gap completely disappear and for women to be in better health for a longer period and have confidence to advocate for themselves, to be able to share when they do have health challenges and be taken seriously and get the adequate care that they need. But ultimately, I think it's about that health gap disappearing and spending more years in healthy, contributing life.
Well, you've certainly given folks the material that they need to build that awareness and to raise confidence, to ask questions, to figure out where to reinvest. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Next up, no matter how much you prepare for a meeting, sometimes you have to go off script. Here's senior partner Sharina Ibrahim.
I was a new partner, and we had a team meeting with a client who had asked us a question not quite related to our study, but wanted to know if we had any views on topic X. The team had done a good amount of work to actually pull together some pages, and we started to have the meeting with the client. And about 10 minutes into it, I was watching the body language of the client, and he was truly disinterested in what we were talking about. And the poor team was continuing on with our presentation. And so I said, let's take a break for a minute. And I stopped and asked the client, are you getting out of this what you had hoped for? And he really was like, not really. And so we paused and I said, why don't we put the paper aside? What is it that you really want to make sure we're spending time on? Because obviously we didn't quite hit the mark of what we thought we wanted to talk about today. And it turned out, between the time that he asked the question, his mind had evolved into the topic. And so we just put everything aside and we said, okay, let's engage on that. We may not be the experts in the room to have that conversation, but we can get partway based on the work we've done. We can do some first principles problem solving, and then we can come back and make sure we evolve the discussion from here. And it was actually a really great meeting. The client really appreciated it. And what I learned from that is, you know, you really just need to read the body language in the room. You need to release your agenda as well and have confidence in yourself that between the people in the room, we can actually move the conversation forward. And it may not be like the perfect answer, but that's okay. And it was actually a much better collaborative discussion with the client and really set us off on a good foot for the next meeting.
Thanks so much for listening to the McKinsey Podcast. I'm Lucia Raheli.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro.
Find us on McKinsey.com. We'll have a transcript of this episode up shortly.
And download the McKinsey Insights app, where you can find this podcast and other helpful content updated daily.
If you enjoyed the show, we'd love for you to leave a rating and a review.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.